Yosef's brothers went to shepherd their father's sheep in Shechem. And what did Yaakov tell Yosef to do? He says to him, "Halo achecha ro'im bishchem. Aren't your brothers shepherding in Shechem? Lecha go ve'eshlachecha alihem. I will send you to them." And then he says, "Lech na re'ei, please go and see es shalom achecha, the peace of your brothers, ve'es shalom hatzon, and the peace of the sheep, v'hashiveni davar, and bring me back some word." And that's, you know, in Pasuk Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet, that Yaakov requests from Yosef, go check on your brothers, go check on the sheep. What's Yosef's response? It's the last word in Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayomer lo, he says back to Yaakov, hineni, here I am, I'm ready. So there's three things that this hineni means. And Rashi introduces these by asking a question, right? What does Rashi ask about it? He says, doesn't Yosef know that his brothers are jealous of him? Doesn't he know that his brothers hate him? Doesn't he know that he's in danger if he goes there where nobody's looking? Who knows what they'll do to him? Why is he so ready and prepared and eager and willing to go when it's putting himself in danger? So Rashi makes the following observation. He says that there's three different good midos, virtues, that Yosef displayed when he said hineni. The first one was anava, which means humbleness or humility. And maybe I'm nervous, but my father obviously is not nervous. He's asking me to go. He's obviously not nervous. So I am going to say, I'm probably wrong. He's probably right. I'm being humble. So that's one of those three good midos. It's being humble, saying, you know something? I'm not necessarily the biggest know-it-all. I don't know everything. Other people know better than me, and I'm going to respect my father's judgment that it's safe. The second good mida is the mida of zrizos, which means doing something quickly, not being lazy. So in other words, sometimes when we're nervous, it's not really nervousness, it's really laziness. I don't want to do it, and so I'm going to be nervous that it's not safe, and that's my excuse not to do it. But very often, you know, we pretend, we trick ourselves even, and we pretend that our laziness is really nervousness. So Yosef says, you know something? I feel nervous, but maybe that's really just laziness. So I'm going to just overcome that laziness, and I'm going to go in spite of everything. And the last good midah that he shows is kibud avaim. He says, you know something? It might be worth it, you know, to be a little bit uncomfortable or unsafe in order to make my father happy and listen to his request. And so those three good midos are humbleness, zrizos, and doing things quickly and not being lazy, and kibud avaim. We also suggested, based on the Ar HaChaim, that something else might have motivated Yosef's response, and this is question 5. The Ar HaChaim said that Yosef was always looking for ways to show his brothers that he trusted them. And he was hoping that if he kept on showing how much he trusted them, they would realize that he's not their enemy, but rather he's their friend. If he trusts them, then they'll trust him back. And we saw that by the dreams, that he shared with them these dreams, and he left himself open to being insulted or ridiculed or put down. He says, I'm trusting you with my secret dreams, because I trust you that you're going to do the right thing. You're not going to use them to hurt me. And now he seems to be doing the same thing again. I'm trusting you with my safety. I'm going alone. It's one of me, 10 of you. I'm going there alone because I trust you. And hopefully if I show you that I trust you, then you'll show me that you trust me back. The Pasuk records, though, that that Yosef was on his way.
No incline to my office, please.
That Yosef was on his way to the brothers, and an ish found him, and he was wandering or lost in the field. And according to the Ibn Ezra, this word ish is referring to a man, like a regular man. But according to Rashi, the word ish is referring to an angel. Because we know in Tanakh, when the word ish appears, sometimes it means man, about 90% of the time it means man, and 10% of the time it means angel. We find particularly in the book of Daniel that the angels are described as Ha'ish Gavriel, the Ish Gavriel. Right? The Rambam explains that there's 10 levels of angels. There's the Ofanim and the Chayos HaKodesh, right, and the Seraphim, and the lowest level are called Ish, because that's the level which is closest to man. And so the angels that are the lowest level are called Ishim, because they're closest to, you know, being weak like humans are. So Rashi says that in our story, the Ish that found Yosef was an angel and not a man. Again, in Hebrew, who found Yosef, that was the Ish, according to the Ibn Ezra, it was a man who found Yosef, and according to Rashi, this is question 11, it was an Ish, an angel, that found Yosef. Now, people wonder, and the Mefarshim of Rashi also wonder, if Ish 90% of the time means man, and 10% of the time means angel, why does Rashi here think that the Ish means angel? Why doesn't he say that it means what it usually means, which is a man? And so they bring a lot of different, you know, little things that when you put them together, they also seem to point in the direction that this particular Ish was probably an angel. So for example, the Mefarshim ask, this is question 12, why did Yosef assume that the Ish knew who his brothers were? He says, have you seen my brothers? Wait a second, describe what your brothers look like. He doesn't need to describe what the brothers look like. Angels know things. Why did Yosef assume the Ish knew who they were? Because he was an angel, so of course he knew. Again, other commentaries say, why did Yosef assume that the Ish knew where his brothers were? Not every stranger who offers to help you knows the whereabouts of your brother. Yosef says to them, tell me where my brothers are. How does Yosef know that this Ish knows where his brothers are? But if the Ish is an angel, it makes a lot of sense. Angels know lots of things that we don't know. So Yosef encounters an angel. He says, ah, you can tell me where my brothers are. Why is it important for us to know that Yosef got lost and someone found him? So again, you know, this detail, the Torah doesn't tell us what Yosef ate for breakfast. Torah doesn't tell us, you know, how many hours he slept for. But this detail that he got lost and the Ish found him, the Torah is sharing with us. And it wouldn't share it with us if it was just a random thing. But if this is like God sending an angel, because it's critical for the history of the world, for Yosef to be at that pit at that time, then it's important for us to know. This was so important for world history that God like sent an angel in order to make it happen. And that is another reason. Why is it important to know? Because it was an angel. Why is the Ish described as finding Yosef rather than Yosef being described as finding the Ish? Usually if you're lost and you want directions, you go looking for someone to give you directions. But here it says that the Ish found Yosef wandering in the field and the Ish asked Yosef, right, who are you looking for? And so it seems that the Ish was sent by God to find Yosef because it was an angel. Why is there an Ish motif in the Pasuk? It says Ish in the Pasuk many more times than necessary. Vayimtza'ehu Ish, and Ish found him. Vayishaleu ha'ish le'mor, and the Ish asked him, saying, what are you looking for? Right? And Vayomer ha'ish nasu mizeh, that the Ish said they traveled from here. Why not just say Vayomer nasu mizeh? Why repeat Ish, Ish, Ish over and over again? It's to draw your attention to the fact that this is not just a regular Ish. This is an angel. Again, the Ish seems to know, this is question 17, that Yosef is looking for something. He approaches Yosef and he says, the Ish asks him, what are you looking for? Who says Yosef is looking for something? But if the Ish is an angel, angels know things. So how did he know that Yosef was looking? Because he was an angel. So these are five of the things that, again, each one, there's a different answer as well, but all five of them together seem to point in the direction that this Ish was an angel, and these are five of the many proofs or things that Rashi notices in the Pasuk that lead him to say that the Ish was an angel. Where did Yosef leave from? So it says, in Pasuk Yudalid, that Yaakov sent him by Yishlacheyu me'emek Chevron, from the valley of Chevron. That's where he left from the valley of Chevron. Where was he supposed to find his brothers? In Shechem. It says, Halo achecha ro'im b'Shechem, aren't your brothers, right, shepherding the sheep in Shechem? That's in Pasuk Yodalid. The brothers were supposed to be in Shechem. But where did Yosef actually find his brothers? That you find in Pasuk, in Pasuk 17, right? The Ish says to Yosef, Nas'u mizeh, they traveled from here, ki shamati omrim, because I heard them saying, Ne'elecha dosaina, let's go to Dosan. So, Vayelech Yosef achar echav, Yosef went after his brothers, Vayimtza'im, and he found them, Bidosan, in Dosan. Why is it important to know the names of all of these places? We actually checked on Google Maps and we found out that they're literally like a 24-hour walk away from Hebron. So they're far, far away from their father. But Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky makes an interesting observation. This is question 21. Why weren't the brothers where they were supposed to be? And he answers and says that Shechem was a place where there were a lot of anti-Semites. And if you feel that you need to have a fight with another Jew, you're not supposed to do it in public. You're not supposed to do it right, where there's going to be negative media attention. It's supposed to be someplace private. Again, hopefully we won't have any reason to fight with anybody else. But if we have some sort of a good, legitimate reason, it shouldn't be done in public. So they went away from Shechem, where all of those anti-Semites were. They went to Dosan, which was a quieter, more out-of-the-way place. They felt, again, we'll talk about this later, that they needed to fight with Yosef. They felt threatened. They felt that he was trying to kill them. But they said, even though we're fighting him in self-defense, we don't want to do this in public because that would make a Chilul Hashem. Question 22. What three words in the Pasuk describe what the Shvatim did before Yosef got close to them? And those words are in Pasuk Yudches, which says, Vayisnaklu oso lahamiso. It's the last three words. Vayisnaklu oso lahamiso. Those are the Hebrew words that describe what they did before he came close to them. And there is a machlokes about how to translate these words. The Targum says that the word Vayisna klu oso lahamiso means that they conspired to kill him. But the Sefarno has a different translation. He says that it's a very big word, Vayisna klu. And the significance of all of those letters there that make the word so big is that it doesn't mean they conspired to kill him. It's a little bit of a longer idea. They thought that he was conspiring to kill them. That's really what the word means. They thought that he was conspiring to kill them. And they decided if he's trying to kill us, then we need to kill him in self-defense. And the Sefarno brings three proofs for this idea that the Shvatim felt that they were acting in self-defense. The first proof of the Sefarno is, he says, we know that the Shvatim are treated by the Torah as heroes of Jewish history. The names of the Shvatim are engraved on the Choshen of the Kohen Gadol in the Beis HaMikdash. The Torah keeps on naming the descendants of the Shvatim after them. When somebody is an evil person, we're supposed to erase their name and forget their name. The fact that the Torah wants us to keep on remembering the names of the Shvatim proves that they remained tzaddikim. The second proof that the Sefarno brings is, he says, usually if a person like murders in cold blood, they feel guilty afterwards, unless they're like a psychopath. If you do something that evil, you feel guilty afterwards. But, he says, the Shvatim, they never feel guilty about it. Even like looking back, when all sorts of misfortunes happen to them, when they're imprisoned in Egypt and accused of being spies, and they're like doing some soul searching, what could we have possibly done wrong that made these misfortunes happen to us? They don't say, oh, we were planning to murder our brother and then we threw him in a pit and then we sold him as a slave. They say, well, we should have cried when we did it. So it's like strange that they're missing like the big thing of like selling him as a slave, and they're focusing on this little thing. Oh, well, we should have cried more when we sold him. But if you understand that they did it in self-defense, it makes perfect sense. They didn't think there was anything wrong with the fact that they sold him. And the only thing they could think of is that even though it was necessary to sell him, but they should have cried while they were doing it. So that's his second proof, that when they were trying to figure out what they had possibly done wrong years later, that could have caused them to get thrown in prison, it never occurred to them that they had done wrong by trying to murder him and sell him, because they felt they were doing that in self-defense. And it's not wrong. It's right to kill in self-defense. The last thing he says is that in halacha, there's a rule that if you kill somebody, you're supposed to fast for the rest of the day. Unless you kill in self-defense, then you don't have to fast. He says, what did they do right after they threw Yosef in the pit? They sit down to eat a meal. He says, obviously, they don't think that they're just like murdering him. They feel that they're doing what they did in self-defense. And that's why they're comfortable eating after they throw him in the pit. So those are the three proofs of the Sepharno. Question 26, what was the first thing the Shvatim wanted to do to Yosef HaTzadik? The first thing they wanted was to murder him. Later on, I ask you what word in the Pasuk shows us that. It's Lechu V'Nahargehu. We'll get to that soon. What was the second thing the Shvatim wanted to do to Yosef HaTzadik? The second thing they wanted to do was to throw him in the pit. And the question is, what changed their mind between the first thing and the second thing? And so if you notice, if you look in the Psukim, it seems that Reuven tries to persuade the Shvatim to leave Yosef alone. In Pasuk Chaf Aleph, it says, Vayishma Reuven heard, Vayatzilehu miyadam, and he tried to save him from their hands. Vayomer, and he said, Lo nakenu nafesh, let's not take his life. And then in Pasuk Chaf Beis it says, Vayomer alehem Reuven said to them, Al tishpichu dam, do not spill blood, hashlichu oso, throw him, el habor hazeh, into this pit, asher bamidbar, that is in the desert, viyad, and a hand, al tishlichu vo, don't send against him. And for those who are familiar with the Mi Amar Lemiz, who said to whom, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Lo Nakenu Nafesh, it's Reuven to the brothers. Who said to whom, Pasuk Chaf Bet, Al Tishpichu Dam, Ashlichu Oso, it's Reuven to the brothers. So both of these psukim are Reuven speaking to the brothers. And that raises a question, right, about the words Vayomer Alehem Reuven that appear in the beginning of Pasuk Chaf Bet. If Chaf Aleph is Reuven speaking to the brothers, and Chaf Bet is Reuven speaking to the brothers, then there's no need to remind us in the middle of the speech that it's Reuven who's doing the speaking. It should have just given the whole speech straight. Lo nakenu nafesh, al tishpichu dam, hashlichu oto el habor hazeh asher bamidbar. Why does the pasuk interrupt in the middle of the speech to say, oh, vayomer alehem Reuven, Reuven said to them, you said that already. So the Ramban has an interesting theory which might explain this. And the Ramban says that Reuven made two separate speeches. In his first speech, he tried to convince the brothers to leave Yosef alone entirely, not to touch him, not to kill him, not to throw him in a pit, not to anything. Leave him alone. Keep him safe. But Reuven's first speech failed. He wasn't able to convince the Shvatim to leave Yosef alone. And so after he abandoned and gave up on that, he tried a second speech. And the second speech was making a compromise. I can't get you to leave Yosef alone, but at least maybe I can get you to give him a little bit of time, not to kill him directly, not to kill him right away. And that's Pasuk Chaf Beis. Al Tishpichu Dami, Reuven gave up now on saving Yosef entirely. Now he's trying to make a bargain, to make a deal with the brothers. If you don't kill him right away, I'll stop protesting. And that's Pasuk Chaf Beis. So since they're two separate speeches with two separate purposes, that's why the Torah separated them. The first speech is introduced with Vayomer Reuven, and the second speech is again introduced with Vayomer Reuven to tell us that they were two separate speeches. The first speech was meant to convince them to leave him alone totally. The second speech was like a compromise, a deal, a half measure. Right? Okay, let's make a deal. You leave him alone for a little bit longer, right? And I'll give something to you also. Based on the Ramban, we explained why the Torah only records three words from the first speech. That was a speech that failed. And a speech that fails, the Torah is not going to give so much press. It's a great speech, it's the one that succeeds, that the Torah gives more words to. And so since the second speech succeeded in convincing the brothers, that is why the second speech gets so many more words. What Hebrew word in Chumash shows that the Shvatim wanted to murder Yosef HaTzadik? That is, there's two places where it says it. In Pasuk Yod Ches, the last word, Vayisnaklu Oso Lahamiso, they conspired to kill him. And again in Pasuk Chaf, the third word, Ve'ata, and now, Lichu, go, V'nahargehu, and we'll kill him. So it's very clear that when people learn this in elementary school, they don't realize that the Shvatim originally wanted to murder Yosef. They think, oh yeah, they threw him in the pit. That wasn't plan one, and it wasn't plan two. It was plan three. Plan one was literally to just murder him right then and there. Now, there's a general rule that when you're negotiating, you don't want to say, do this because it's good for me. You say, do this because it's good for you. And so Reuven is negotiating with the brothers. The brothers want to murder Yosef right away. And Reuven wants to throw Yosef in the pit. And the question is, what's in it for Reuven that he's willing to have him Yosef thrown in the pit? Like, why doesn't he just hold out for the maximal position? Save Yosef, save Yosef, save Yosef. Why is he willing to give in and stop protesting? And what's in it for the brothers? Why are they willing to give up on their original plan of murdering Yosef? And so there's three answers to the second question. Three answers to the first question and two to the second. So going in order from 34, according to the Meshech Chachma, why was throwing Yosef in the pit safer than leaving him at the Shvatim's mercy? And the Meshech Chachma says an interesting line. He says, it's better to be at the mercy of wild animals than to be at the mercy of humans who behave like wild animals. And during the Holocaust, we saw a lot of that. Everybody knew that you were better off in the forest than at the mercy of the Nazis, because when humans behave like wild animals, they're much, much more cruel than wild animals. So Reuven thinks, right, it's good for me, it's good for Yosef to be in the pit, because he'll get more mercy in the pit than he'll get at the hands of his brothers. 35, the Arachaim's explanation about why it's better for Reuven and for Yosef to have Yosef thrown in the pit. So the Arachaim gives a very interesting introduction. He says, we know that there's two basic ideas in Judaism. One of them is called reward and punishment, which means that God gives good people all the reward that they deserve, not a single drop less than of reward than they deserve. And God gives bad people all the punishment that they deserve. They never get punished less than they deserve. There's another rule in Judaism, basic rule, which is called free will, which means that God doesn't interfere in the decision of a human to choose to do good or to choose to do evil. God doesn't interfere. He gives us free will to choose good or to choose evil. The question that the Aruch Chaim asks is, what happens when reward and punishment and free will are in conflict with one another? What if a person chooses to use his free will to make someone suffer more than that person deserves to suffer? Which of these two rules is God going to give priority to? Is he going to say, this person, the victim, doesn't deserve to suffer, so I'm going to take away the free will so that he doesn't suffer? Or does God say, free will, I don't interfere in people's choices of good or bad, so I'll let this innocent person suffer more so that I don't interfere with the evil person's free will and his choice, his free choice to cause this extra suffering? So the Aruch Chaim, at least over here, he says that that free will is the stronger rule. And so God will allow a human to use free will, even when that free will cause an innocent person to die. Someone who doesn't deserve to die can die if a human with free will chooses to make him die. However, animals don't have free will. So if a person doesn't deserve to die, then he might be in a pit with lions or snakes and scorpions, but God is not going to let those animals kill him, because reward and punishment says, if you don't deserve to suffer, if you don't deserve to die, then you're not going to die. The Gemara tells a story about Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, that there was some sort of a monster or serpent or dragon or whatever it was, and the way that this monster worked is that when it bit you, you had to race the monster to the water, and whoever got to the water first would be saved, and whoever got there last would die. And Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi one time encountered this monster, and the monster bit him, and God made a miracle, and like a well of water opened up at Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's feet, and he got to the water first, and the monster died. And the lesson is that, you know, animals can't kill you unless you deserve to die. If a person doesn't deserve to die, then the animal will not be able to harm him. So Reuven felt it's safer for Yosef in the pit, because if the brothers kill Yosef, they'll be able to kill him even if he's innocent, because they have free will. But if he's in the pit with wild animals, he's not going to die unless he's really guilty. If he's innocent, then the animals won't be able to harm him, because the animals can't kill a person who doesn't deserve to die. And finally, Rashi, which might be the simplest explanation, why was Yosef safer in the pit? Rashi says, well, because Reuven's plan was that when the Shvatim left Yosef in the pit, he was going to come back and pull Yosef out of the pit and rescue him, as opposed to if the Shvatim had killed him right away, then there would no longer be any chance of rescue. What's in it for the brothers? Why? I see what's in it for Reuven, that he was willing to stop protesting if the brothers agreed to throw Yosef in the pit. Now, there's three reasons why, right? It's in Yosef's best interest. How did he convince the brothers that they were going to gain from not murdering Yosef right away? So the Ramban, and this is 37, the Ramban says that throwing Yosef in the pit was better for the Shvatim than murdering him, because the Shvatim were essentially good, compassionate, merciful people. And when a person has compassion, he doesn't want to become cruel and violent. So the Ramban says it's better to kill someone in a less violent way than it is to kill them in a more violent way. So Reuven is basically suggesting, if you throw him in the pit, it's less direct. He's going to die from starvation or from cold or from heat or from wild animals. But you are not directly chopping off his head or stabbing him in the heart. It's less direct, it's less violent, and so you preserve and save more of your mercy and compassion. If you chop off his head, then you're making yourself into a more violent person than you want to be. So that was why it was in the Shvatim's interest not to murder Yosef directly, because this way they're able to save more of their mercy and they don't become cruel people. The Sefarno gives a slightly different explanation. He says the Shvatim thought that they were killing Yosef in self-defense. They thought that Yosef was coming to kill them, and therefore they have to kill him. But there's a rule about self-defense, and this is question 39 and 40. It's forbidden to kill in self-defense when you can save yourself, when you can defend yourself by just injuring the person who's attacking you. So it's only permitted to kill in self-defense when there's no other choice. But if there's another way to defend yourself, you have no right to kill. So Reuven says to the brothers, he says, you guys are not evil, psychopathic murderers. You guys are good people who feel that your lives are threatened. That's why you're trying to kill Yosef. So he says, you have no right to chop off his head or stab him in the heart. You can defend yourselves just as well by putting him, lowering him gently into this deep pit where he won't be able to harm you. And the Shvatim say, hey, you're right. We have no right to kill him. So we just have to put him in the pit. And so because they're good people and they want to do the right thing, Reuven says to them, you can't kill him. You got to put him into the pit. So that's why they wanted to put him in the pit. It was good for them because it lets them continue to do the right thing. According to the Sfarno, why is it so hard to tell the difference between forbidden and permitted self-defense? So the Sfarno's point is that you have to make this decision, split-second decision, right? Because if you take too long, then you've lost the chance. The guy is coming, right? He's trying to, you know, to murder you, whatever it is. If you hesitate a moment too long, then you've lost the opportunity to defend yourself. So this is literally life or death decision. If the guy is really innocent and you kill him, then you've killed an innocent person. If the guy is really a murderer, he's trying to kill you and you don't kill him, then your life is gone. Because you made the wrong decision, you know, you end up losing your life. And you have to make this decision, either your life or this other person's life. And you only have a split second to make that decision. It's incredibly difficult to make such a hard decision so quickly. 42. What was the third thing the Shvatim wanted to do to Yosef HaTzadik? The third thing that was, they wanted to sell him as a slave. And we connected this to the idea of Mida Keneged Mida, which means, Mida Keneged Mida means that the punishment matches the crime. And so we talked a little bit, if the barber slips and, you know, shaves like a bald, you know, line up the back of your head, you know, what is it that you might have done that this is like pointing out to you that you should now like be working to fix? So maybe you were too into looks, or maybe you insulted somebody else because of his looks. And so now, you know, like you're going to have, you know, problems with your looks, or maybe it could be something else. Maybe you were, you know, problem with your haircut, with payas, whatever it might be, right? There's this idea that the punishment matches the crime. And when something happens to a Jewish person, they're supposed to ask, why is this happening to me? It's a message from God that I should be doing something better. What should I be doing better? And then they're supposed to change. And the punishment is like a pointer, an arrow from God pointing at what they're supposed to change. And so when the Shvatim see these slave traders passing by the pit, they say, whoa, this is a message from God. It's Mida Keneged Mida. It's telling us from God that we're supposed to sell Yosef because that's the punishment that matches his crime. What was his crime? That he thought he was going to be the boss over everyone, that we're going to bow down to him, that he's going to boss us around. Well, guess what? Now he's going to be a slave and everyone's going to boss him around instead of him bossing everyone around. It's a perfect match. And so they say, oh, it's a message from God. We should sell him as a slave. So the Pasuk tells us, and this is Pasuk, Chafhei, Vayeshvu lecha lechem, they sat down to eat bread. Vayesuenehem, Vayiru, they lifted up their eyes and they saw. Vihineyem, behold, Orchat Yishmeilim, a caravan of Arabs, Ba'am Yigilad, was coming from Gilad. Ugimalehem nosim, and their camels were carrying Nechos, Utsri, Valot, sweet-smelling spices, SSS, sweet-smelling spices, Holachim, Lehorid, Mitzrayim, going to bring it down to Egypt. And that was the cargo of the Arabs who took Yosef to Egypt. And Rashi learns a lesson from this. He says, even when Hashem needs to make a tzaddik uncomfortable, even when Hashem needs to put tzaddik through suffering, it's not because he hates the tzaddik. If any of us suffer, it's not because God hates us. Chas v'shalom, God loves us. But sometimes there's such a thing as tough love. And the way that you show love, right, if you just let your love shine forth, that's very dangerous. Yaakov let all his love for Yosef shine forth, and look what happened because of that. It caused jealousy and hatred, and ultimately got Yosef sold as a slave. So God, you know, sometimes practices tough love, and sometimes he needs to make a person uncomfortable or suffer, and sometimes to suffer really badly for reasons that sometimes we do understand and sometimes we don't understand. And sometimes we only understand it after many years, and sometimes we only understand it after we're dead. But God, everything that God does is because of his love for us. And so he tries always to give us a little sign that even when we're suffering, a little sign that says, I love you. It's like if you have to punish a kid, right, and you know, put them in time out, give them a little hug first, right? I love you, but I have to do this because you're being so wild and you're a danger to your siblings, so I have to put you in time out. But I love you, so I give you a little hug before I put you in time out. And so God does that also. If a person is looking, even when things are really terrible, there's usually going to be one little thing, if they look carefully enough, right? That's a sign from God, I love you. Right? You know, I was driving on the highway one time and the traffic was so heavy and I was getting more and more and more frustrated. And like, just as I was like about to like explode, I saw on the other side, like a cute pun, you know, Cain is Abel. That was the name of a company that was running a truck. And I couldn't help but chuckle. And I said, you know something? God saw that I was getting so frustrated and he sent me a little joke to sort of lighten it and make it easier for me. And so that's what happened for Yosef, that even though things were terrible, his brothers had just, you know, threw him in a pit and then sold him as a slave, right? But I've got these sweet smelling spices for the couple of days that I'm journeying to Egypt, which is a sign that God loves me in spite of everything that's happening. The brothers, as we said, sat down to eat as soon as they sold Yosef. As soon as they threw Yosef in the pit. But Reuven wasn't there. He did not take part in that meal. And we learn this from the pasuk Chavtes and Lamed. It says, "Vayashav Reuven el habar." Reuven returned to the pit. Where is he returning from? He wasn't there. At the meal, he wasn't there when Yosef was sold. And, you know, Rabbi Salvechik, elaborating on Rashi, gives the following explanation. He said, why was Reuven gone? Why didn't he stay to eat the meal with them? So he explains that the moment that they sat down, that they put Yosef in the pit, Reuven suddenly felt terribly guilty for something that he did years and years ago. Many years before this happened, after Rachel died, Yaakov Avinu moved his bed into the tent of Bilhah. And Reuven was very upset. He said, this is a wrong decision. My dad made the wrong decision. He should have moved his tent into his bed into the tent of Leah. Leah, like Rachel, was noble born. Bilhah was a maid. And it's an insult to my mom, to Leah, that Yaakov is giving special consideration to this maid over my mother, who's noble born. So he said, obviously Yaakov made a mistake and I'm going to correct that mistake. And so he took Yaakov Avinu's bed and moved it out of Bilhah's tent and into Leah's tent. Now, obviously this was very insensitive to his father's feelings and very disrespectful of his father's judgment and inconsiderate, but he did it. It was impulsive, and then he kind of forgot about it, like, okay, no big deal. Now, suddenly, his younger brothers are doing something which is incredibly disrespectful to their father's judgment and insensitive to their father's feelings. And Reuven, being older now, is trying to convince his brothers not to do it, but he fails to convince them, and they threw Yosef in the pit. And Reuven's wondering, how could my brothers do such a insensitive and disrespectful thing? Where in the world did they get this from, this chutzpah, to do this? And suddenly he realizes, you know where they got it from? They learned it from me. They learned it from what I did when Rachel died. I was insensitive and disrespectful, and now they're just imitating me, and I had forgotten about it. I feel awful. If I had done the right thing back then, maybe my brothers would have done the right thing just now. And he says, I can't eat with you. I need right away to do tshuva. I'm taking a fast on myself. And he runs away to fast and to do tshuva. In the Hebrew words of the pasuk, this is 49, What did Reuven say when he found the pit empty? So that's in Pasuk Lamed. It's the last six words. Hayeled einenu va'ani ana aniva. And the literal translation of these words, do not use Sefaria's translation because it is not the literal translation. The literal translation is, the boy is not, and I, where will I come? Or where will I go? And the Aruch Chaim explains, what does it mean? Where will I go? So in class, a lot of guys had good explanations, but the Aruch Chaim says the following. He says that the responsibility of an older child is to guard the safety of the younger children. It's also to set a good example for the younger children. Part of it is to guard the safety of the younger children. Reuven knew that when he got home, the brothers got home, and Yosef is not there, Yaakov Avinu is going to tell him, you are the oldest, you are the Bechor, you're responsible for the safety of Yosef. Go and find him. Lead a search party and bring him back. He said, if Yosef had still been in the pit, I would have known where to look for him. But now he's gone. Where in the world will I go to find him now? I'm the Bechor. I'm responsible. Where am I going to go now to fulfill my responsibility to find Yosef, to keep him safe? And that's his anguished cry, Hayeled einenu va'ani ana aniva.